I only know that the only thing I can think of that brings that about is time alone with him. I'm not sure what else would do it. I am surprised. I guess I should comment. Part of it is what's happened to our culture. But to meet young staff, I mean new on the staff, and find out they've never had a day alone with God, to find they've never read through the Bible, that distresses me terribly. In fact, it would distress me if I started probing here, because I would discover probably there are any number of you that may never have read through the Bible completely. And it's just, it seems like we're so ready to be active and so unwilling to wait upon God. The reason we go to him is to get his mind on things, to get his perception about life, to get his counsel about how to live and what he wants of us, so that we live for him and not for others. I'll get to that. In the surveys, as I looked at this thing of trying to draw out, can I find a concept of a balanced life from all that I've seen? And I jotted down there probably four areas that came out from the surveys. One was the idea of no extremes, kind of well-rounded, or balancing the secular and sacred. Well, I've tried to destroy that idea. Because I don't, well-rounded idea is out of the Greek philosophers that was carried into the British tradition of being kind of a nice, well-rounded amateur in all things. But it's not a biblical idea. And so we've worked on that probably more than we need to. Another area had to do with the whole thing of goals, priorities, responsibilities, or time, energy, relationships, that area, and we will get into that today. I simply tried to bring that under an umbrella so that it doesn't usurp a place that doesn't belong to it. A third area, and we've been speaking about that in this particular study on Philippians 3, it had to do with the will of God, pleasing God, eternal perspective. And then a fourth area that came out of the surveys had to do with maturity. Luke 2:52 was used in that, and I would simply say that be careful how you handle Luke 2:52. The purpose that Luke 2:52 is there, Jesus increased in wisdom, stature, and favor with God and man, is simply to identify his humanity. It's not to set out for us areas of priorities of life in which we need to assess our growth. It's simply to say, that's what makes up humanity. And so we can identify with that. Now it's all right to use it and say, well, you know, my social—I don't seem to relate socially. I don't have good interpersonal relationships. That highlights something for me that's a need. That's all right. But to try to set forth life in these things and lay out objectives and plans and all that, I'm not sure is. You can tell I'm hitting a lot of Navigator sacred cows. So understand that I am in the minority when I say some of these things. And you don't have to accept my thinking. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is when we talk of balance, it's in whose mind? By what criteria? The person who's training to become an Olympic athlete, how balanced is that person's life? They give up almost everything. You see these girls that are 13, 14 years old on swimming teams, and what do? They're up at 4 in the morning so they can be at the pool for 2 hours of practice before they go to school. And then after school, they may swim for another 4 hours or exercise. I mean, their whole life, they don't date, You talk about relaxation, they don't. What's happened is a consuming purpose. Now, do they feel cheated by that? When I had decided at a point in my life, before I met the Navigators, by the way, that I would not date because of where I was, I felt I've been a heathen for so many years, I desperately need to be undistracted. I desperately need for God to get hold of me. So I just went, Bible, Bible, Bible. I quit reading newspapers and magazines for a while. I set aside reading at the library. I love to read, and I just set aside all that, and for a year or two, just invested myself in getting consumed by the Bible. Out of balance? Unhappy? I was in the Army. Living in Open Bay, a guy comes over to me one day when I felt so low, so miserable, life seemed so dark. Virgil came up to me and said, Roger, what makes you so happy? And he came to Christ. And really, I was happy. I was contented. But my life looked way out of line. I remember the chaplain and others trying to counsel me about my imbalance. Well, I would say balance by whose definition, whose criteria? You have to say balance within what confines, within what limits. Paul could talk to you about balance within the limits of my passion to be Christ's man. Well, let me give you a quote here. I think that this quote sums up at least my concept and somewhat of what I think Paul is saying here. A master in the art of living draws no sharp distinction between his work and his play, his labor and his leisure, his education and his recreation. He hardly knows which is which. He simply pursues his vision of excellence through whatever he is doing and leaves others to determine whether he is working or playing. To himself, he always seems to be doing both. Now this relates to joy. I love to work. I've been working since I was 10 years old. Really. And I love it. I enjoy it. I like the challenge of it. It is a form of recreation for me. The work I get to do has so many demands and changes and breadth of scope of things that I have to deal with that it's always a challenge to take to it the mind of Christ and learn what Christ has for me with it. It's always an opportunity to learn and grow. It's always an opportunity to have some fun with someone in the process of working through a project. I don't see it as, and then I go home. It's not, oh, now I've got to figure out what my objectives are for my family and do that. It's, now I get to have a good time with the family. Now I get to enjoy them. Now together we'll spend some time enjoying the Lord. It's life as God intended it. It's not this. But it's a mix of learning, growing, being educated, being challenged, being stretched, having demands on me, all of life. And I simply move from one to the other. I take my work home and then I'll say, I want you to know about this thing I was wrestling with today. Why do I do that? I'm teaching my children. I want them to grow spiritually. I want them to have things that they're capable of understanding to challenge and help them grow in their own wisdom. I don't take everything home, but I'll choose things. There's an interrelationship. I draw heavily on what I'm learning from my family to share in ministry. Life is life. It's not a series of things. That's what that's why I like that quote. Yes.
Theoretically, it ought to be the same for the guy on the assembly line in the pecan factory in Podunk, Iowa. But how?
It's where has God placed me? And I'll go back to that because I've been in that position. And part of it is the way God's put me together. But when I dug ditches, for me it was a challenge. How beautiful can I make this ditch? How straight? How smooth? You know, where it really, and how efficiently and rapidly can I accomplish the job? So any job became a challenge to me because of the attitude that I took to it. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at here. That ditch, picking up butts. Now that I hated in the military. I've never smoked, even as a heathen. Everybody in my family smoked. I despised the habit. And I was around it all my life. And then as a Christian to go in the army and have to pick up butts that other people tossed, that just irritated me no end. But it became a challenge to let Christ show me the value of picking up butts and to decide how I could accomplish that in a way that brought him honor and glory. That's life. Does that answer that, Cal? Let's see if there's anything else here that I felt would... let's define then balance. Maybe define life. From what we've said, and from your own studies, what are some things, how would you define this idea of living, of life, or of balance in the context we've been using it? Okay, any other thoughts? Kind of the idea, I know what I'm supposed to be doing, and that's what I'm doing. Is that right?
I'm in control. Not just how I'm doing, but how I'm seeing it. But I'm in
control. Is that right? Have I still missed it? Okay. I've tried to pick up some elements at least there.
I think doing those things always with an awareness that you're in the presence of God and letting that knowledge affect
you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's see, you said obeying God, trusting Him. Okay. Let me use this one. And by the way, as I wrote this, I thought I need to do a lot more thinking. But just based on these couple of passages we've dealt with, I thought one way I may begin to approach this is to talk about it as a life consumed by a passion to become Christ-like and to express and experience His life in every situation, a life that is ever moving forward to greater maturity. And I would base it on verses 15 and 16, the idea that keep moving on. Okay, in our next session, we're going to have a look at a biblical view of time, and then the idea of functional and relational aspects of life, and that'll take us up to lunch. Then after lunch, we're going to start trying to get into the thing that I think some of you wanted to hit, having to do with goals, priorities, planning, that kind of thing. Okay, we'll take 10 minutes. Some of you, I'm sure, have attended Christian seminars on use of time, management of life. And Ephesians 5, 15, and 16 is usually referred to at some point in the seminar. So we might as well turn to that, and we'll end up using that passage just for a very brief excursion into the concept of time, not enough to really come away with a brand new definition, but enough, I hope, to challenge you to rethink our view of time. Now, for those of you who have been in time and management seminars, how is Ephesians 5 usually brought into that context? All right. Yeah. Be active. Keep make every moment count. Idea. Hard as you can go.
It just usually brings it in the area of the value of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's valuable. It cannot be replaced.
Uh-huh.
Replaceable.
Mm-hmm.
And just that's why we should put a high priority on things.
Mm-hmm.
Use our time.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on it? All of which I've put in my workshop. So
I've heard an illustration about that. We had a bank account that every day, $186,000 or million or whatever it is, was put into that, and we had to invest that that day. And at the end of the day, whatever was left in that account was taken out, and we couldn't use it again. We would use all our energy to invest that money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what time is, because that's how many seconds are in a day or whatever. And so you use
okay.
your energy to invest that.
Good. And all of these are ideas, as I worked on time and management seminars to help around the navigators, those are things that I drew on. And what I'd like you to do now is turn to your small groups. And I'd like you to look at the context in which he states this and determine how he wants us to use time from the context of Ephesians 5, just by way of a little survey as you look at the passage together. I think if you read 1 to 20 together and then just tried to sketch out, in this context, how is he telling me to use time? So I want you to get into your groups. I'll give you just about a little less than 5 minutes to, or 10 minutes to do that. Brainstorm together. Okay, let me interrupt you. And I want you to stay right in your groups because I want to take this one step further. But just a couple comments. As you've looked at this, what are some thoughts that have come out on how Paul wants us to use time from Ephesians 5? What are some things that surface?
He doesn't give us specific things to do and not do, but general things to apply to everything we do.
So it's a kind of a general overview. It's not do this, this, and this, but it's here's some general principles for living. Yes, good. Okay, we're back to that, aren't we? Okay. What I did, and this isn't an intelligent way that I summarize some thoughts there. What does he want me to do? He wants me to live a life of love. He wants me to live a good life, a moral life. He wants me to live as light so that I rebuke what is dark. Do what pleases God, and he wants me to live in the Spirit. That's his concept, just his basic overview of what he's asking for. Now, so he's not talking so much about getting things done as just my approach to life, how I'm living, which is important. Now I'd like you to look at 5:15, particularly, how am I to live? How am I to approach life? What am I to do with opportunities, and which ones, and why? Okay, just a series of questions. How am I to live according to 5:15? How should I approach life according to that verse? What am I to do with opportunities? Which opportunities, and why? Now, there may be better questions that we could ask. I just wanted to put us on a little track here. I'll give you another 10 minutes to kick that around. Maybe we could just take the opportunities section as a more definitive thing first. What did you see about opportunities in this passage? Okay, we're to make the most of them. In fact, has anyone done a study on this where you know the word that's behind that? Pardon? It's to redeem, to buy back, to buy up. So that it's... what's that?
Portuguese redeem.
Ah, good. Okay. Portuguese has it right. Okay, so opportunities will come, and we need to do something with them when they come.
I think we need to use wisdom that God gives us to be acquired. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Often we have several opportunities offered at once, and we must use the wisdom of God to choose which brings us to be closer to the goal.
Yes. What kind of opportunities do you think Paul has in mind in the light of this context here? Pardon? To do bad things? To do good things.
To do good things and expose the bad things.
To do good things and expose
the bad things. Yes? Uh-huh. Okay, Cal?
First verse, you've got the idea of knowing God and obeying Him, loving Him, and serving Him sacrificially by service to others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
glance at them like we do roads on a map that don't take us where we want to go, and find the ones that do take us where we want to go and say, what are the optimal opportunities I have to serve others in loving, sacrificial obedience to God?
And what I would add to that, Julie, you wanted to say something?
I think I see more than ever consisting of the interpreters is doing faster more than they should be. And just being a lack of overflow.
Okay. I think what it's not somebody comes and asks me, will I teach a class as an opportunity? But, well, yesterday is a good example. I was sitting in the office, table full of notes and stuff and books, and a bunch of conferees walked by, and I recognized a couple of them. Well, my first inclination, because of the way I am, was just to kind of turn and and continue. And instead, I jumped up, ran out there, and said hi to one or two people I knew, introduced myself to one or two others, and a minute later was back in my seat. Now, I don't view my position as being anything, but I know they do. And the fact that Roger Fleming, who spoke to us Sunday night in that great message, he came and said hello to me. that's an exaggeration, but it's... But do you see what I'm getting at? That meant something to them. It was an opportunity to do good, to say, you are really important. And they need to hear that. They are. And so it was a momentary thing, and I really don't think it took me more than 2 minutes total to get up, go there, and come back.
Okay, about this, I saw here doing, but I saw being sure because you say things with the Spirit. How you can do for the Spirit?
Uh-huh.
And that's the reason that you can do anything good that is talking because you have the Spirit. If you don't have,
yes.
Then.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think that's the primary thing. It's simply, as the outflow of life, if there's an opportunity to show love, if there's an opportunity to do something that's a good deed, an act of kindness, if there's an opportunity to confront evil, to expose it for what it is, then take advantage of it. Don't let it go by. But we get locked into a very narrow way of thinking that says, let's see, that means I've got to take this activity at church, or I need to be involved in this Bible study with the Navigators. And those are legitimate opportunities, but I just want to broaden our perspective on that a bit beyond specific event-type activities or whatever. Did you want to say something, Fred? I saw you move, and I thought, okay. Now, what I'm trying to lead us to is to a little bit of exploration on what has come to be a functional view of life. In other words, time must produce something. It's a view that has carried over where when we meet someone in our context, in the culture of the United States, one of the first words out of our mouth is, what do you do? And not only do we want to know what do you do, but kind of what have you accomplished? What have you contributed? How useful has your life been? So I've done a little reading by this man, Jacques Ellul, who's a Frenchman, a layman, a philosopher. And I'm not necessarily recommending you read his stuff. It's rather heavy for me. But he is talking in this chapter about the effect of technology on all of life and how it's affected the way we view life, how we think, and our approach to life. And his point is that originally technology, or in the French technique, and there's a distinction, would be, I have a shovel. The shovel is a tool. I use the shovel to dig. That's my practice. But it is not, how efficiently can I design a shovel to do more faster, so that I'm now not simply using a tool, but I'm evaluated in terms of how efficiently and how much digging I produced in a day. Does that make sense? And he says, technology passed through a rational intervention, and it had a completely different object. No longer is simply a tool to use, but its object was efficiency. And it's a grave mistake to regard technology simply as machines. It has gradually come to encompass all human activities. By this I mean, there is now a precise knowledge of how a group or society is constituted. We've done studies on group dynamics, on the psychology of groups. We know a process. I've read a book, The Change Agent, How to Move In. It was written by a man, how to affect social change, how to come into a community, what process you need to go through in order to affect social change in that community. So we see how society evolves, how it's constituted, how one can organize to achieve a certain result. Psychological technologies are exactly the same thing. So now it's not simply, do I want to advertise my product? But now I know we've studied the process of the human mind. We know that we can flash words on a screen that won't even be registered with the eye, but will with the brain. We know certain appeals to human nature by our studies of psychology. So now when we want to sell a product, we put together all that knowledge, and there's a whole process that goes into creating an advertisement to achieve a certain end. So the whole thing is a technology. It's not just a small part of our activities. It tends to encompass all of life. Athletics is a tremendous example of that. It used to be that there were natural athletes who had developed themselves and had their own style and technique, and they ran according to that. Chariots of Fire would give you the contrast between Eric Little and his natural style that was just a development of God-given ability, and this guy Abrahams, who took the technological approach to sports, which was so offensive to the British. But what we've done now, we film. And so we can take an athlete, and we no longer allow him to develop his own technique. We give him step by step every single little movement and program him in order to achieve greater and greater efficiency. And so technology rules his whole approach to his sport. So he says we are dealing with what is basically a power covering the full range of human life. This expansion of technology to human groups, to human life, is one of the essential characteristics of our world. Now, there's much more to it than that, but I simply wanted to give you a little introduction to when people talk about people viewed as functional beings. That's the kind of thing they're talking about. How useful am I? What have I done? And now, here's what we do in disciple making. See, initially, Dawson Trotman was ministering to people, right? He had a vision, something burning in his heart. When I went out on my assignment in 1965, they told me, go to San Diego. That was my job description. Those were my instructions. Now, I knew there was a military work there. I knew that's what I was getting into. I also knew San Diego State was a few blocks from the house. But I ignored it for a variety of reasons. I'd been there a year or so, and you know what happened in the Navigators in that time? We had our first training center with Walt Hendrickson. And I began to feel very inadequate and very inferior, because now we had a process. We had a technology on how to develop disciples. And I was sure that I didn't know what I was doing. And I became more and more sure of that as I got into more and more frustration in the ministry. And because now someone had found the process so that they had the assembly line laid out, and they could take a person step one, step two, step three, step four, and at this end, we would have a real navigator disciple. And we have spent the last 20 years or so refining that process, that assembly line, that technology of how you make disciples. And then we wonder why things are not going well in the navigators. Here's what happens. I want to get together with Mark and Holly. You know what's in their mind? He's got something that he can teach us. Because their viewpoint of our time together is it will be useful, it will be productive, it will count for something. It has to be. That's the view of life we hold. You know what happens to me? I think, gee, I just can't come and be their friend. I've got to figure out how to come up with something for my devotions this morning, or a little Bible study I've done this week, or a verse I've been memorizing, just so that they won't walk away disappointed. And so our time becomes functional, not relational. And that kind of viewpoint can be destructive to real disciple making. Well, the problem is, functional is kind of what I do, and in the crab context, that would be my significance. The relational area, who am I? I love, I am loved. That's the security aspect. What I want to point out here is that God has created both. Genesis 1, 27 and 28. It's wonderful that in the very first chapter of the Bible, God tells us what we're like. 27, so God created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. What's that talking about? It's talking about relationship. In the image of God speaks to our relationship, our ability to know God, to relate to him. That makes us distinct from all the rest of his creation. The image of God. And then, in 28, he blessed them, said to them, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subdue it, etc. What's he talking about? Function. He's given us something so that we can be significant. We can be involved in the very thing that God does. He creates, he makes, he does things. Well, that's a marvelous thing. Mark 3:14. Jesus ordained 12 that they should be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. Two aspects again. The relational, to be with him. The functional, that they might do something. I think the problem comes when I try to measure only by one. And when I do that, It distorts life. John 21 is a good illustration of this, where we have Jesus restoring Peter. What does he do? Peter, do you love me? How's our relationship, Peter? Feed my lambs. Out of our relationship, here's the function I want you to fulfill. Now, when Peter felt an absence of that relation, what did he tend to do? What was he doing in the first part of the chapter? He returned to the functions that he formerly had. I'm a fisherman. And Jesus was saying, Peter, you're not a fisherman. You're a fisher of men. I have called you to my side, and I've not abandoned you, and all your failures mean nothing. Our relationship stands. So there's a close interaction here between both. And I would say that our problem in life is when we fail to distinguish between plan and purpose, form and function, intent and method. Example, scripture memory. Now, why is it that we want people to memorize scripture? Okay, to know the mind and will of God. So the word of Christ will dwell in them richly. A lot of reasons. Now, all those things that you referred to, do you have to do scripture memory for that to happen? What do we really want? We want to fill up their hearts and minds with the word of God. Well, so you meet someone that you're trying to make a navigator disciple, and they hate memory. So in your navigator mind, you say, oh, well, they can never be a navigator. I'll go find someone who will memorize. What have you done? You've replaced function with form. You've taken method and replaced the intent with the method. The means have become the end. And so we tend not to deal with people in terms of who they are and what their needs are, but in terms of our process. That's just a simple illustration, but it affects so much of how we approach life, not just disciple making. And that's why I felt it was important to take a session just to think about time and function and relationship, so that we break out of this view that everything has to be efficient, useful, productive in the way we've been molded to think. Because sometimes doing the opposite accomplishes far more. One of our senior staff came back from overseas, so as the RD, I got together with him, and we spent about 2 hours just sharing the Word together. I opened the Bible and said, "Let's." And he said, "I can't tell you how many years it's been since a navigator staff man sat down with me just to talk about God and His Word." Well, why? Because we view our meetings as having to produce something. And so we get locked into business or the program or the syllabus, and we forget this is a person who also needs relationship. It's 10 to 12. We'll quit. Julie?
How would you approach
a meeting with Margaret Holliday? Oh, I'd probably come with any number of things. But I spend a lot of my time trying to break down people's ideas that I've got to give them something. And I will ignore questions people ask, maybe to their frustration. I will try to spend a lot of time asking things about them. It isn't that I don't have a plan. It's simply that I want that to sit in the background. And I'm not frustrated if I don't get to it. In fact, if I'm meeting formally with someone, I have a three-part plan. Pray, plan, or a fellowship, plan, my plan, progress, and pray. Now, and I major on the fellowship aspect in that I just want to relate. Because Jesus said, "Be not called teachers, for you have one teacher and Lord, myself. And all of you are brethren." And so the fellowship allows us to share our lives on a common level that assures our humanity under His Lordship. my plan helps me to ensure that I am giving them help where they need it. And then the prayer aspect brings it back so that we're, again, two human beings under the lordship of Jesus Christ, praying about the things that we discuss together, growing together, learning together, experiencing his life together. And so with a fairly new relationship, if I were spending an hour or 2 hours, probably three-quarters of that time would be spent in what I've labeled fellowship. For a new believer, I might spend 5 to 15 minutes at the most, at 15 at the very most, on my plan. I can do most things that I have in mind in 5 minutes or less. And then prayer, 2 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever.